So let's get started. I thought that today, before we get to the book of Exodus, if we do get there, we should do a recap since we completed the book of Genesis and talk also about the larger meaning of the Joseph story and just the themes that run through the book as a whole, even though we understand that in some ways, none of the books of the Torah is designed or intended to be self-sufficient. I mean, they're part of a larger whole, but still, it's worth taking a look at the ideas behind it so that we can then move on, because it's clear between Bereshit and Shemot, between Genesis and Exodus, there is a thematic break. That is, it goes from family to peoplehood, right? There is no people Israel in the book of Genesis, really. There's a family Israel, but no people Israel. And the people Israel is when we discover them in slavery in Egypt. All of a sudden, there's a nation, whereas before that, there are kids, but no nation. So I want to start with the opening ideas that then trace through the rest of the book. And the opening idea, of course, and in some ways the guiding idea of the entire Torah, is that God makes the world, right? That's where the book starts, is that God creates the world. And it's not just that therefore everything owes its existence to God, but it's a very undeist form of point of view, which is not only does God create the world, but God continues to superintend the world. And that idea, which is what gives religious believers both their hope and their problems, that God is somehow involved in the world, runs all through Genesis in a really interesting way, which we don't notice because we're so used to it, which is that even though God superintends the world, people have choices to do what they want, which is a really strange combination if you think about it. Because if, for example, as we will see when we get to discussing the Joseph story, if God wanted to get the Jews down to Egypt, does that mean that the brothers really chose to put Joseph into slavery? After all, didn't God plan this all out at the beginning? So the degree to which everything is God's responsibility and our responsibility is another question that gives religious believers headaches, because on the one hand, we don't like ever to give up the idea that human beings have free will and responsibility. On the other hand, we don't like to give up the idea that in some ways God superintends the world and ultimately what is supposed to happen happens. So that as I said, that's the sort of guiding idea behind the entire book of Bereshit, of Genesis. And then the second idea, which we've mentioned before, that comes fast on the heels of that, is that we live in a broken world, right? Adam and Eve leave Eden because the world is unredeemed. Better, an unredeemed world is really an imperfect world, a non-utopian world, a world in which things will always go wrong and go bad, and it's a place that is not Eden. And deep in the Torah, even though we may not like this idea, but clearly deep in the Torah and in the story of Adam and Eve that follows from the rest of it, is that the reason the world is so broken is because of us. We're just no good much of the time. Okay, not all the time, but much of the time. But we're not irredeemably bad, according to the Torah. I mean, this is not the Christian reading, obviously, of the story of Eden. This Christian reading is we are irredeemably bad, and therefore Jesus has to come so that we can be good again. But in the Jewish reading, we're not irredeemably bad. We're just powerfully tempted to bad things, and it's impossible to live a life without bad things. There is no one so righteous that he does always the good and never sins, says Ecclesiastes, right? Later on in the Tanakh. So we start off with God made the world, God superintends the world, God created these creatures that have a powerful drive to do the wrong thing, and that in fact violate the very first commandment almost immediately after it's given, right? All God says is don't eat from that tree. That's all God tells them not to do. It's the only thing. And then of course they turn right around and do it. Which we, by the way, we understand instinctively, because that's, if you leave a kid alone in a room, right, with a jar of rocks, and you don't say anything, the kid won't touch them. If you say, do not touch those rocks, I'm going outside, by the time you come back, you can be sure there will be like chocolate fingerprints all over the rocks. That's the way people are. They have this perverse desire to do that which they are told they're not allowed to do. So the third theme is that because God's initial experiment with human beings is unsuccessful due to human beings' innate perversity, their innate desire to do bad things, their inability to follow God's directions, because of that, God eventually decides, after the flood and after the Tower of Babel, God eventually decides to take one representative people and to try to mold them into something better as an example to other human beings about the way people should be or could be. Okay? That's the basic narrative of the first 12 chapters, because Abraham is called in chapter 12, the first 12 chapters of the book of Genesis. And that sets the frame for everything that follows. The problem is that we get so involved sometimes in the story we're reading that we forget the larger frame, which is the point of all this is God's trying to make this one people follow God's way as an example to the world, because when God tries to civilize the entire world, he fails miserably, right? Again and again. Even with two people in Eden, God fails. And then don't forget what happens with Adam and Eve's kids, right? Or Cain and Abel. The first murder, the first siblings, the first murder. And the start of all of this is inside the family, because the family is a microcosm of the problems that afflict humanity. And there's nothing I would venture to say, I haven't given this a lot of thought, in fact, I've given it no thought, but I'll try it anyway. There's nothing that happens between nations that you can't find an analog for within families. So, since you're all nodding, good, I feel on steadier ground now. Because that's just the way human beings work, is, you know, that's where we learn resentments, fights, grudges, forgiveness, love, incompatibilities, all those sorts of things. And I don't know whether it's ever been done, but it would be a really interesting study if someone would compare the average family structure in a country with its foreign policy and see if there are any parallels with the way it acts in the world and the way its families work. Because my guess is that you would find some cultural similarities, and that the foreign policy of a place like India is going to be different from the foreign policy of a place like England, in part because of the differences of the family structure. Although England and India had enough interaction over the years that it probably got blurred. Anyway, so once Abraham and Sarah enter the picture, and God wants to create this representative family, God also wants to create a place for that family to flourish. And that's Israel, right? So there's not only a promised people, but a promised land. And the notion, which really never entirely comes to be, is that when Israel is secure on its land, it will be a representative people for the rest of the world to look at and admire and emulate, right? That's the idea. We still cling to that idea in some ways. We tend not to think about the fact that it doesn't work. Even in the Bible, it doesn't work. It's not like when David was king of Israel that everything was great, or when Solomon was king of Israel that everything was great. But that's the idea, is a representative people in a representative land, and they will be then a model for the world, okay? So Abraham, and as soon as Abraham and Sarah take over this responsibility, what tends to happen is that the family conflicts, as well as the promise and faith, sort of go hand in hand. That is, Abraham has this tremendous, and by the way, this is very interesting. I just read an article about this 2 days ago by Menachem Kellner, who's a scholar of Maimonides. And it seemed, he was comparing Maimonides' view and Rashi's view, Rashi being the great Jewish commentator. And I never realized this, and I need to really talk to some like expert Maimonidean to follow up on this, because this is kind of shocking in a way. But he brings several sources from Maimonides that say, that is Rambam, the greatest Jewish philosopher and one of its greatest, one of our greatest legalists. He says that God didn't choose Abraham. Abraham discovered God, and in that discovery was the choice and the creation of the Jewish people, which is not the narrative we usually hear. It's very different. But basically what Rambam is saying is if someone else had chosen God, it would be a different people, but because it was Abraham, the seed of Abraham became, which first of all makes Abraham even more important in the history of humanity, but also is, I mean, now you can take either view. I just think it's interesting that a major figure in religious history sees it as really Abraham's, I don't know, revelation in some ways, but not revelation from God, rather revelation of God to him. It's in a book called Rashi and Maimonides that tries to contrast all sorts of various things about their different views. As soon as that happens, though, you discover that it's not just that you need this faith in order to proceed, but that the faith seems to be carried by certain people and not other people. That is, by Isaac and not Ishmael, by Jacob and not Esau, right? There, it's not as though it's sort of a genetic thing, but it's also not a genetic thing. That is, you are born to it, but just the fact that you're born to it doesn't mean that you are going to be the person that is carrying it on. And very different, obviously, from the way Judaism evolves later. So when you get these series of families, you feel as though God's word is a kind of fragile message that will only continue if all these obstacles are surmounted. Don't forget, Abraham is in a war, right? Of the five kings against the four kings. He gets killed in the war. That's the end of Judaism. Jacob runs away from home. As you know, in the ancient world, it's not like there was a Holiday Inn, right? He puts a stone down and he lies down and he has this dream of ladders, but you know how dangerous it must have been to travel and to sleep out. And don't forget, it's not just that there were dangers from human beings. There were dangers from wild animals all over the ancient world. We don't think about that anymore because you're not going to find a tiger out on the street. But in the ancient world, of course, there were roaming animals all over the place. Once you get then to the kids and to the story of Joseph, which is what I want to concentrate on this morning, you get this. You get in parallel these family problems and dynamics, and you could name them over and over again: Yehuda and Tamar, and Shimon and Levi and Dinah, and the massacre at Shechem. I mean, every single time the family is mentioned, it's problematic. I can't think, with the exception maybe of Abraham and Sarah feeding the angels, there's almost no, and Isaac being comforted because of Sarah's death, there are virtually no scenes of domestic harmony. Every time the family's talked about, it's tsuris, right? It's trouble. And you might say, and I think you could say with good reason, that the Torah is such a spare storyteller. It tells so little of the story that all the scenes of domestic harmony are taken for granted, and it's only the stuff that breaks the pattern that you need to talk about, right? It's only the stuff that's different or notable. I mean, those of you who weren't here, I started off with a story of a dialogue that I had with my daughter this morning. Now, I talk to her all the time, right? But I don't come in the morning and say, by the way, I talked to my daughter again today. Because the norm you don't report on, it's only that which deviates from the norm that you report on. So I don't want to suggest that the families didn't have wonderful moments of harmony. It's just that the Torah isn't going to say, you know, well, Jacob's family woke up and had orange juice today and everybody was fine. So it probably wasn't orange juice in the ancient Mideast, but okay, otherwise. So then you come to the story of Joseph. And the story of Joseph is, I don't know what percentage of the Hebrew Bible it is, but it's by far the longest story in the book of Genesis and the longest short story in all of the Torah. unless you take the separate books. I mean, not in all the Tanakh, but in all the Torah. In the five books, there's nothing that comes close to being as long as the story of Joseph. And it illustrates, I think, the following themes. First of all, and most important, going back to Bereishit, it illustrates that history follows the pattern that God determines for it. That's really the ultimate message, in some ways, of the story of Joseph. I mean, when we study the Bible, partly because of my own interest and inclination, and just partly because I think also of the inclinations of the class, we talk much more about the characters, their motivations, their struggles. But behind all of that, theologically, it's that God told Abraham a long time before that your ancestors are going to be slaves in Egypt, right? Before there was a Joseph, before there were brothers, before there was a Jacob. So the story of Joseph is the story in part, if you read it from a certain point of view, of how God managed to get them down there. Because especially, by the way, as soon as you read about the years of famine and the years of plenty, because so you can say that people make choices about other stuff, but in terms of rain and crops and so on, that has always been seen as God's, you know, there's a lot of prayers for rain in the Jewish tradition and other traditions, because that's always God's providence, who gets to determine the rain and the crop growth and so on. So the fact that they go down to Egypt because of a famine, just as Abraham did, that already lets you know that God is working. The second part of it, though, is consistent, which is we still blame the brothers, because even though it's necessary to throw Joseph into the pit to get him to Egypt, we don't say, well, God arranged all of this, and therefore the brothers are blameless. We hold both sort of incompatible ideas in our mind at the same time, which is God is in control and people make choices. And there are lots of ways, we don't need to worry about it now, there are lots of ways of trying to understand that, but I think there are very few, I can only think of one Hasidic thinker who was a determinist, that is, who decided everything had to be the way it was. But we hold those two ideas, almost all religious thinkers, side by side, and almost all people who are religious side by side at the same time, which is God ultimately decides, but we have all the choices that we have. I don't know exactly how we do that, but we do, and there are, as I said, there are lots of attempted solutions to that problem. Having said that, it's also clear, as it's clear from the very beginning, from the story of Abraham, that in some ways, Maimonides' account is not what I said before, where Maimonides says that Abraham discovered God. You know that couplet that it was originally, Hilaire Belloc is the one who they said wrote it, although it's not entirely clear, how odd of God to choose the Jews, right? And the answer that someone wrote years later was, it's not so odd, the Jews chose God. And that's Maimonides' account, right, is that Abraham chose God, so that's why God chose Abraham. But it does seem as though, in a weird way, and this is actually said in Deuteronomy, that God picks favorites. God loves Jacob. He just loves him, right? Takes care of him. He makes sure he's all right. It's not that Jacob, I mean, if you didn't know that God chose Jacob, especially at the beginning of his life, you wouldn't say, well, obviously Jacob's a good guy, because Jacob's not such a good guy, right? He steals the birthright. Or if he doesn't steal, I mean, even if you want to say he doesn't exactly steal, he tricks his old blind father. He's not, you know, that's not nice. obviously. Yeah, exactly. And then he picks Joseph. Why does Joseph have these dreams? Well, again, if you're looking at it from the point of view of the Torah, right, not modern psychological, not the way that we've talked about it in the class, but clearly the point of view of the Torah is he has the dreams because God gave him the dreams. That's why he had the dream. You and I have dreams because we have dreams, but Joseph's dreams are recorded in the Torah because there's something eternal, divine, predictive about them. I mean, they come true in a remarkably powerful way. So again, you see the hand of God behind everything that's going on, and you see that God chooses certain people, and that sometimes you can act in such a way so that you earn God's favor, which seems to be what happened with Judah and Tamar. Why does Judah get to be the tribe that eventually becomes the tribe of the Messiah? Because he learns from his experience. He acts differently with Joseph at the end of the story than he does at the beginning of the story. And when he betrays his daughter-in-law by not allowing her to marry his last son, and then discovers that she tricked him, slept with him, and is pregnant with his child, instead of berating her, dismissing her, killing her, he says, "You were more righteous than I." He's able to do tshuva. He's able to do repentance. So God chooses him, but only because he changes. He wasn't originally the favorite of God, the way Joseph seems to be, but rather earns his way into God's favor, which is a different mode, which is important for us to know that there are both. There are clearly people in the world who seem blessed in innumerable ways, like they're sort of touched by God. There are the Mozarts of the world, you know, that you can't imagine, just that somehow, like, they were touched on the head by an angel at birth. And then there are people who struggle but eventually achieve that sort of sense of God's grace, I guess. So Judah is the one who struggles. Joseph is the one who has it from birth. And the story of Joseph's fall is the story of his ability in some ways to use the gifts that he was given to also have a struggle. Because I think that it's probably true that people who have an uninterrupted series of triumphs in their whole life, they're not the characters that we affect to. I mean, one of the reasons why, there are a lot of reasons to dislike Joseph if you want to dislike him. But one of the reasons why it's hard to dislike him as much as you otherwise would is this is a guy who suffered a lot and overcame his suffering. You know, we don't think about those years in an Egyptian prison. Could not be a pleasant experience, right? In the ancient world, you can imagine what an Egyptian prison in the ancient world, you can't imagine, actually, I can't anyway, what it must be like. But it's got to be horrendously, terribly awful. And yet, he managed to rise from that to become a viceroy to the Pharaoh, and also to bring his family, and even though he wasn't entirely kind to them, he was kinder than he might otherwise have been. So there's also that overcoming, and all of the biblical characters have that. There isn't really a biblical hero that doesn't struggle. Abraham certainly struggles. Isaac certainly struggles. Jacob, God knows, struggles and overcomes. And Joseph does as well, and Moses, as we'll see, but I mean, you know this, Moses' life is a sort of uninterrupted chronicle of difficulty and struggling. Joseph, too, though, it just follows the pattern that we've seen from the beginning, which is that God makes choices, but he makes choices. His family is not a happy one, right? Maybe the family he creates is, although we don't really know, but certainly the family of origin is not. And for the first time with Joseph, although to some extent, I guess, with Abraham in the wars, but for the first time, the Jews take a place on the world stage. And that's part of the message of the Torah too, which is that the Jewish people actually have a role in the greater drama of humanity. And again, we take this for granted, even though we're a vanishingly small people. I mean, we're tiny, in like 0.02% of the world or something like that. But we take it for granted that we have a role on the world stage, and yet it really doesn't start until Joseph, when all of a sudden, in the greatest power in the ancient world, in Egypt, there is this huge drama, and it revolves around a tiny tribe of slaves, which we know the story, we're used to the story, so it's okay with us, but there's, I mean, it's very hard to predict that that would actually turn out to be such an important story in the history of humanity, and also, as we read it, so improbable that of all the stories of the ancient world, this one would be the one that would end up, you know, being so determinative in human history in so many different ways. And then finally, after all of this drama and all of these themes sort of interpenetrate one with the other, there is Jacob's blessing to his children, which is first of all about the future. That is, that what happens to Israel is what in a famous phrase, Ramban, Nachmanides, said, Ma'aseh avot siman labanim. What happens to the fathers is a sign to the children. In other words, what happened in past generations is what you assume is going to happen in later generations. And this lesson has been learned and sometimes overlearned by Jews throughout history, because we always use our experience as an analogy for what's about to happen. And the problem is sometimes the analogy works and sometimes the analogy doesn't work, right? Now you can see this, every enemy of the Jewish people, whether a minor enemy or a major enemy, sooner or later they're going to get called Hitler. It's wild. It's like we immediately reach for the nuclear historical bomb in the cupboard and we apply it to whoever, because we're so trained to assume that that which has happened will happen again, that and that starts with these prophecies of Jacob, you know, I'm letting you know what will happen in the future, and then it's very hard to escape. So there is that as well, and then the entire arc of the book from creation to blessing is a kind of, in a weird way, a kind of narrowing before it goes out again. It's just like when you see these, it is actually at the beginning of the movie Hugo, if you saw Hugo, but it's at several movies where you start off with a very wide shot. You even sometimes start off with the whole globe, and then it narrows and narrows and narrows and narrows and narrows, and then, you know, you shoot in the window and you see a guy at dinner or something like that. And that's in a way the Book of Genesis works, right? It starts with the creation of everything, narrows, 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 till you get to Abraham and Sarah, and then begins to widen again as their family grows until you come to Jacob and his children, and now you're ready for the real story in some ways of what the Bible wants to tell you, which is the Exodus, which is the centerpiece of the Jewish story, after all, is slavery and redemption. Okay, so let's stop there and take questions and comments. That's a recap of Genesis. Yeah, Marion.
Has anyone ever written a book about what the world would be like without Jews?
Yes. Has anyone ever written a book about what the world would be like without Jews? Sometimes flatteringly, sometimes not, depending on who has written the book. I can't think of... Danny Gordas was working on a book that was somewhat like that. But I can't think of a real, like, counter history, the way people write counter history. What would the world have been if the Jewish people had never been born? My guess is there is such a book. I'm not familiar with it, but yeah.
I guess it's more of a comment. You said that we make up 2% of the...
Less than 2%. We're about 15 million. There are 7 billion people in the world, so somebody do the math. I don't know what that...
I'd like to say we're kind of...
What's that?
1 out of 1,300.
1 out of 1,300? Okay, so what percentage is that?
Yeah. I'm thinking we're even less than that, because like a whole bunch of Jewish community, Jewish people, they either defy or deny or just don't even
identify. They don't identify as Jews. Yes, exactly. That is certainly true. I don't look. It depends how it's counted. I also don't know. I mean, those kinds of numbers are always problematic. I mean, how do you know that there are 15 million? How do you know there aren't 16 million or 12 million or, yeah, and it's shifting and it does depend on how you count. But having said that, it's at least fair to say that it is astonishing how overrepresented we are in the achievements and public notice of the world, given how fractionally small we are. And I don't know exactly why that's true. There are lots of theories about why that's true. But it certainly is true. In fact, just in this morning's paper, there was it in the LA Times this morning? It was in the Foreword. it was in the Forward paper. There was an interview with David Steinberg and Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld's been doing these interviews of various comedians. David Steinberg was here. I don't know if any of you saw him. I had a chance to interview him, which was fun because I remember his routines almost verbatim from the time I was a kid. He did some great biblical routines too. And God tells Noah to build an ark of 40 cubits. Noah says, "What's a cubit?" Scott says, "Yeah, I used to know that." But he said, when people ask him why are Jews funny, he said, and I said in an interview once, "'Cause we're smarter." He said, and I got into a lot of trouble for having said something like that. He goes, "But I still haven't seen the counter evidence." So. But I remember reading once, Charles Murray, the same guy who just came out with a very important book that I haven't read, but I read it's important, so I believe it. I say that like, very important book, like I spent last night reading it. I haven't read it. I saw him on Charlie Rose, okay? David Brooks wrote a column about it. So, and I'll tell you what he said. The central insight of the book is actually really interesting. But anyway, Charles Murray wrote an article and commentary years ago about why he actually believed that the average IQ of Jews was higher. Although, by the way, when we came to Ellis Island early in the century, people thought Jews were retarded when they gave them different intelligence tests. So I wouldn't take this to the whole intelligence testing thing is a little bit suspicious. But part of his argument was in medieval times, the brightest caste of people went to the church or to the synagogue because they were the only literate people. The only literate people were the monks, the priests, and the rabbis. Most people didn't read and write. Some did, but not the most. They didn't need to, right? And he said, and the rabbis reproduced. The monks and the priests did not marry, did not reproduce, which is a very interesting point, at least among the many other things he said. So who knows? But who knows? Anyway, there's a lot of intelligence to go around. But what the other thing that Murray says in his book, this is sort of the central part of his book, was in as much as 40 years ago, not only the income gap, right, between rich and poor was much, much, much smaller, right? In most neighborhoods, somebody who made $100,000 was very rich. $100,000 in today's money, or $150,000, was very, very rich, right? This sort of, but the culture of people who were rich and poor was almost identical. They read the same books, they watched the same shows, they went to the same movies, they drove similar cars when they drove cars. In other words, it wasn't identical, but there was a common culture. And what has happened, he said, in the last 30, 40 years is there's been this tremendous break on both sides. Not only that the poor has become broken in all sorts of ways, but that so has the rich, among other things. The rich now, the family intactness of rich people is much less than it used to be. It used to be that, you know, the divorce rate was very low among the rich as it was among the poor, and the poor it's astronomical and the rich it's very high. But also that there now is tremendous insulation where people live very separate lives, and most people who are wealthy never come into any real contact with people who are poor. Their culture is different, their assumptions are different, and so on. And he said that wasn't true. It's been radically changed in a very short time, and his book is all about the tracing that change and the statistics and so on. It actually was an interesting, important book. Same guy who wrote a very controversial book about intelligence called The Bell Curve. Anyway, all right. So yes, a little digression there. Other Genesis-related questions, yeah. Yes. Okay. Where? Where? Ethiopia. Okay. All right. So, the question is basically, if God wants peace and God wants goodness and God wants unity, why is there all this division and hatred and fighting in the Torah and elsewhere? And there, this is a giant question. It is the religious question. There are lots of different ways that you could take it and lots of different ways that you could answer. Let me just try to restrict it to one question, which is not why there's evil in the world, but why God makes human nature the way that it's made, because that's really the question. I'm not going to deal with why is there disease, why is there so on. That's, I mean, let's say that for another time. Let's just say a word about human nature. So the rabbis have an amazing and daring midrash, an amazing and daring story. When Cain kills Abel, they analogize it to two gladiators in a ring. One kills the other, but it's really the emperor's fault. It's not the gladiator's fault. It's the emperor's fault. He put them in the ring, gave them swords, and said, you have to fight. So Cain, who killed Abel, turns to God and says, you did this. You put us here, and you made us the way we are. I didn't make myself resentful and angry and so on, right? You implanted that in me. So then the question has to be, what's the point of being here in the first place? If the point of being here is unity and goodness and love, then you're right, God did a very bad job, because he put creatures here who are angry and divisive and... But if the point is to transcend our natures, to get to unity, goodness, and love, then he did a very smart thing. That is, he made it extraordinarily difficult. And if it wasn't extraordinarily difficult, there'd be no human struggle, right? If it was easy, so it would be easy, and the world would be a much better place, but it would have, I suppose, a different point. The point being, can we... These, it's sort of a great experiment to discover, can we overcome the parts of ourselves that are lower, whatever you want to say, to create the kind of society that you said you grew up in, but on a larger scale? And that, I think, is, you know, that's still an open question. And I don't know, sometimes you think maybe God tipped the scales too much in the direction of, in the direction of resentment and so on, but it's a hard question. I will just say one other thing about this before I take the question. Steven Pinker, who is a social philosopher and scientist at Harvard, writes on language and other things, just wrote a book that's gotten a lot of coverage and a lot of discussion, and I actually heard him lecture about it last year. Where he claims that the curve of violence in human history is steadily declining. And he brings a lot, he said, even with the 20th century, even with the two world wars, if you compare it to the past, and it's been a much discussed book, he brings a lot of statistics, a lot of charts and so on. He says, if you go even from Neolithic and Paleolithic times to the Middle Ages, you see a steady decline in the percentage of people. He says, just look around you, right? I mean, look at the society that most of us live in. He said the violence of human history, despite the fact that weapons have become more and more and more potent, has gradually declined and continues to decline. And if he's right, maybe, if we don't blow ourselves up too quickly, maybe we'll get to the point that, but it's very, I don't remember what the book is called, but it's Steven Pinker, P-I-N-K-E-R.
And what's his reasoning?
Why does he think it's true? He thinks that he attributes it mostly to science, technology, enlightenment.
Not laws.
Well, law is a big part of it. Part of enlightenment was human-made laws. I mean, he's not a big religion guy. I had a debate actually with him at Harvard about religion. But can I just say something before? His wife is Rebecca Goldstein, the novelist. So I had a debate with him at Harvard about religion, and the debate took place at the Harvard Hillel House, okay? And I've read his stuff. He's a beautiful writer, he's very easy, he's very witty, he's very clear. He's really, I mean, you read his book, The Language Instinct. I'm not particularly interested in the origins of language or so on, but it's a fascinating book. And he's very well regarded in the field of evolutionary biology, and so he's a professor at Harvard. I mean, he's a smart guy with And a charming, and a charming, nice person besides. So, okay. He's married to this woman who also writes novels about religion and so on and so forth, and is also not, I mean, she grew up Orthodox, not particularly favorable to religion. And I know I'm going to debate with him about whether religion is good or bad. So we get up, and the guy introduces us, is the head of the Hillel House at Harvard, and he said, you know, Rabbi Wolpe, blah, 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 and Steven Pinker, whom you all know, of course, because he's always so helpful to us at Harvard. Harvard Hillel. And I think, okay, this is the kind of Jewish atheist I like, right? He helped them at the Hillel House. He identifies it. It just doesn't. So anyway, it was an interesting chat, and I've seen him since. He's quite a remarkable guy. Yeah. Are you calling God controlling? Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, I don't look. There is no question. If you read Harold Kushner's book on the Garden of Eden. It's clear, as he says in that book, that it is a setup. But it's a setup because it has to be, because human beings can't actually live in Eden. They have to get out of Eden. Because the only place where there's struggle and life and growth and remember do you remember the first thing we studied this one? I mean, it was a long time ago. I still don't remember how many years ago we started the Torah class, but do you remember the first thing that Adam and Eve do? Was it 7 years? 7 years ago. It took us 7 years to get through Genesis. Although we had some breaks for illness and other things along the way. But do you remember the first thing that Adam and Eve do when they leave the Garden of Eden? The very first thing?
They dress.
No, when they leave. They dress in Eden.
Oh, right.
They have sex. The very first thing they do. In other words, it's outside of Eden that there's growth and change and passion and love and all the things, good and bad, that characterize human life. So what Kushner says is, you're right, exactly. God set them up, but God set them up because what's Eden? I mean, Eden is nothing. It's like all those episodes, if you remember the old Star Trek, like there must have been 10 episodes where they would go to a planet where everything was perfect. And at a certain point, either Kirk or Bones, who was the doctor, they would say, you know, we can't live with perfection. We have to go back on the ship. And they would, inevitably, they would leave the perfect place and they would go back on the ship where everything is struggle and strife and where you get a show next week. Yeah.
In the book sale, there was a wonderful children's book on Greek mythology, which mm-hmm. I bought for Gabby's classroom. And we're reading it the other night. The second story in there is the story of Pandora's box.
Mm.
And it amazed me, as she and I were drawing parallels, it was the Garden of Eden story.
Right, she's not supposed to, don't open the stupid box.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And of course they will, just like in the horror movie, they'll always open the door.
And there were repercussions, yeah. And that was a wonderful opportunity for me to ask her, so yeah. What happened after Adam and Eve,
yeah.
You know, what were they?
She said they made it.
No, she didn't. She said, the serpent had a crawl on the ground. And
right.
His leg.
That's right. Those were the consequences. Yep. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Some weeks ago, you talked about darkness. That's where we are.
I talked about darkness.
Darkness will veto goodness and life.
Yeah.
I'd equate this Hobbesian notion almost mm-hmm. that man is born ugly.
Yes. Right.
And we're born that way.
That we're born in darkness because someone wanted us that way. So, I mean, look, think of it this way. For most of human history, people lived exactly the way you said that Hobbes characterized life, right? Nasty, poor, brutish, and short. Because we've probably lived in caves a lot longer than we've lived in, you know, Western sophisticated societies, which means that it was a long, difficult climb out of darkness into, and we all live lives, as you know, that like ancient kings couldn't begin to dream of. So, yeah, I mean, if you the idea was, I'm going to try, I'm with a minimal amount of direction, I'm going to try to plant this species here and see if they can grow towards the light. Then you would say that, you know, that could be the drama of human history. But it's a very painful one, and you have to decide whether the pain is worth the, whether the game is worth the candle, as the old expression has it.
Is my memory correct that you, in a way, when you talked about the darkness, said, no matter how small it is, it vetoes all of light. It always prevails.
No.
No.
No, what I did say, I didn't say that darkness vetoes all of light. What I did say, which is true, is that destruction has a vastly disproportionate power over construction. You know, how long would it take to knock down this building that took years and years to build? Or how long, as one of my favorite examples, I don't remember where I first heard it, all it takes is one bad driver to snarl the 405 for hours and hours and hours, but it takes many people not texting to keep it going, right? So it's true that destruction has a disproportionate power, which means, by the way, that because the world is, when everything works, it means that people are generally, their default mode isn't to destroy each other, or there would be nothing left of us. I mean, we must have a lot of goodness in us because it's working. And the truth is, all it would take for this class, for example, to ruin the class would be one person who would, I don't know. I mean, it's very easy to disrupt the class. You know that, yeah.
I believe that we learn so much more from adversity or destruction or whatever than we ever do from everything being perfect, like the Garden of Eden. And I think that's the beauty of the book of Genesis. And it, because it shows all the adversity, right. All the traumas, all the, you know, the negative things that happen to families.
Yeah,
and
exactly. We do learn more from adversity, without question. The fly in the ointment is it depends how much adversity, because there's adversity that can be crushing or destroying or killing, literally. So you have to just get the right amount of adversity in order to grow, and not such the adversity that, yeah. Depends. It depends whether you think the canvas is essentially lit or not. I don't know. Yeah.
God gave us a choice, mm-hmm. and that's our difference with the animals. If there was no bad, and it would just be good and good, then we really have no free choice.
Right. That's Maimonides' argument. That's Maimonides' argument, exactly, that you have to have evil in order to have goodness, that there's no goodness without. I don't know. Yes. And I think that that's true on two separate levels, both of which you said. One is that it teaches you where we started off the class about self-knowledge. You say you can look back and you say, look, I got through that, so I'm going to be able to get through this. That's one thing. And that's one of the reasons why there's this beautiful statement by George Eliot, the writer, the one who wrote Middlemarch. She said, childhood is soothed by no memories of outlived sorrow. In a way, when you're a kid, it's harder because you don't remember, oh, I was through sorrow before and I got through it. So the first time something bad hits when you're a child, you think it's going to be forever. Whereas when you're an adult, you know somewhere, I'm going to get through this because I've gotten through stuff like this before. That's one thing. And the second is, you're right, we have a certain sort of deep, innate respect for people who've suffered greatly because we understand that it's taught them something that we can't fully... Like, you remember when Elie Wiesel came here, it was like... You thought, okay, this guy actually has the right to speak because he's been there in a way that, thank God, I never have, never will, in a different way. So it's both things. It gives us a sense that somebody who's really suffered knows stuff that we don't know, and it also gives them a resilience because they know they made it through that suffering, so what can you do to them? You know, it's like... it teaches you tremendous resource. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Okay, so last one, yeah.
Okay, I want to bring it back home.
Okay.
Where you said that nothing happens with nations that can't be an example, but happens with family.
Mm-hmm.
And how that applies to temple life. see that in...
In the synagogue?
In the synagogue life?
So, well, I always assume that it's about the way that, let me put it this way. I'm of two minds about it, because I think sometimes the way you organize things makes a big difference. And people show different parts of themselves depending on the structure that they're put in. As just an example, this class would be a very different class if it were in a circle, and I were sitting as one seat in the circle, as opposed to my sitting up here on a high chair and all of you in a semicircle, like obviously when you come in, the class is about me. And you know that and it just, so the structure of something really does change the way people act. Having said that, and so therefore when you change the structure of the synagogue, it does, I mean, I think about the sanctuary that way. When you walk into the main sanctuary and you, there's this bima that's very high, like the prow of a ship, it tells you something about the way you're supposed to be in this place. Having said that, I give even more sort of, not credence, but more weight to the personality structure of the people involved in any particular thing, and that's partly genetics, but a lot of family. I mean, I learned how you're supposed to relate to people and how you're not supposed to relate to people by watching early, I mean, as we all did, by watching parents early on and just getting those lessons, good and bad. So, and it is less, then you bring it home, you bring it back to the original dialogue that I mentioned this morning, it is less about what they said specifically than about the deeper messages that you receive by how they acted toward one another. So I think that that's true, and the sort of the DNA of the Torah in terms of the Jewish people is the kinds of stuff that I was talking about, which is about the weight of the past. And also I think that we can't ignore the not just the weight of the past, but the forward motion of the Torah. It's always, we're going to get to the land, and there's a certain ambition and dynamism that the Jewish people have also in their DNA, and I think that's partly because there's always this goal, always, and you're supposed to get there, and you're supposed to, and also I think it's partly the immigrant experience too, because every time an immigrant comes to a new place, they feel like they have to prove themselves. So there's that as well, and I think that it's played a very powerful role in the way Jews have, and also, and just to tie it together to finish, also it's tied to the suffering question, because Maurice Samuel, who was a writer, said that he thought that the reason that the Jews have survived was because they decided they were not going to disappear until they figured out what this was all about. they'd gone through too much, and they just needed to know what this was about, and they were not going to step off the world stage until they did. He was also the one who said, by the way, speaking about Judaism and its moral tradition, a wonderful phrase, when he talked about why the Jews were not loved in the world, he said, "Nobody loves their alarm clock." It's a good one, isn't it? And on that note, please rise.